Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers and sisters. Welcome to today's chapter of the Big Picture Show. You're live on Radio Islam International and as well as a live feed to the Radio Al Ansar listeners in Durban. I'm your host for today, Mustafa Darsot, standing by for Brother Abid Dawji, who unfortunately is not available. Please make dua for his dad, who has taken a bad turn yesterday with his health, and their family is there around him at the moment. Now, what will we talk about today? Well, there's a few matters. I'm sure all of you as listeners are tired about listening on about the COVID issue, and you know, every week there's some sort of thing that's related to it. And yes, it's a very important topic, we can't just deny it, but we need to also focus on matters that are challenging us and not to forget those important matters. And one of them is the Rohingya issue, something that is not going away and won't go away for a long time until the Rohingya people get their justice. And with me on the line, we have Sister Shabnam Mayat, who is an advocate based in Johannesburg. She is the co-founder of the Protect the Rohingya movement, which is an SA South African awareness group that was established in 2012. Sister Shabnam, are you on air?
Yes, I am. Assalamu alaikum.
Hello, Assalamu alaikum.
Hello.
Wa alaikum salam. How are you, Sister Shabnam?
I'm good, thank you very much.
Wa alaikum salam. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I think there's just a bit of delay in transmission. Okay, Sister Shabnam, well, as I told the listeners that, you know, one matter that must not be forgotten of, amongst the various challenges that face us as an ummah is the Rohingya matter, and or the plight of the Rohingya, if I would call it that way. And alongside, we've got the plight of the Uyghurs, the Kashmiris, the Palestinians, the Syrians, the people of Yemen, and so many other places as well. But for now, you know, since you are the specialist in this area and have been amongst the voice here in South Africa leading this campaign and this effort and awareness, we would like to ask you the following questions, just to for the listeners to get an update from you on what's happening. And we can start with, what's the situation regarding the coronavirus or the COVID-19 in the camps? We've heard about the outbreak in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh.
So obviously everyone's been really worried about corona coming to the camps, because firstly the situation in the camps, I mean, you have around 60,000 people living per square kilometer. Everyone has to queue up to share bathrooms, to share water. There's obviously not enough clean water. Most of the water is contaminated in the camps. Not enough medical facilities. We have around 12 people living to a shelter, and these are very thin walls, bamboo next to each other. And of course, the lack of isolation facilities and ventilators. We're looking at like 18 ventilators in all of Cox's Bazar, and the drive from the camps to Cox's can take you up to 2 hours. And then last week, one person passed away in the camps. It was an elderly man. They're around 29 to 30 confirmed cases, and a whole lot of people have been isolated. In fact, the route to three areas in the camps has been totally closed. And it's a real concern, because with the internet ban, they've been, of course, the Rohingya in the camps have been under an internet ban since 2019 September. And what has happened is, as a result of that, the information is not really filtering through. I mean, organizations are going door to door. They are cycle announcements. There's announcements going around by tac-tac, but it's not reaching everyone. I mean, a million people is a lot of people to reach. So people believe that, for example, if you are a good Muslim, you won't get corona, or if you go to an isolation center, you know, you will be killed, or you will be given corona, or that it would be an opportunity to take you away and move you to Basanchar. And we all know Basanchar is the uninhabitable island that now the Bangladeshi government has put structures on, and it's on a floodplain, and it takes 3 hours by boat to arrive at. So people are really, really afraid, and they're not getting the message. And as as corona starts to surge through the camps, if that is what is going to happen, then it's a real danger because there is really no way to look after everyone and to provide proper medical care for everyone, because humanitarian aid to the camps, of course, is also now working on a skeleton staff just to prevent the coronavirus from spreading.
I see. That's very sad to know, in the sense that, there's obviously social distancing is an impossibility, and knowing there's a million people in that area, and what 60,000 per square kilometer, it's just too shocking and frightening to grasp the reality that they're facing. And going to in the Rakhine state, what's the situation there?
Okay, so we must remember that in Rakhine State, there's still around 600,000 Rohingya that are living there who were in 2012. Hello? Can you hear me?
Sorry, no, I couldn't hear you. I lost you there, but it's okay.
Okay, so in 2012, 140,000 Rohingya, after the violence in Sitwe in Rakhine State, they were put into concentration camp-like conditions in these IDP camps. There's still 600,000 Rohingya that live in Rakhine State. They're subject to the worst conditions, checkpoints, no access to medical. They can't even move to the next village. They have no way of protecting themselves. In fact, someone driving an ambulance taking COVID supplies was killed recently, and there's currently a war continuing between a separatist group called the Arakan Army versus the Myanmar military, and the Rohingya are stuck in the middle of that. So the situation in Rakhine State is really terrible, and there's no access for those Rohingya to aid, and they're still subject to the same military that perpetrated the genocide. So the situation is really dire, and I don't think that the Myanmar military or the Myanmar government is providing proper care and protection against COVID to those living in Rakhine State.
Sure. So the thing is that, just on this Arakan Army, I'm just going to digress here. The Arakan Army, who are they really fighting for if they're Rohingya in the middle?
They're Rakhines, that is their area as well. They come from there, and they want more access to services. They want their own, their own homeland, practically. They want their own space, and they want government to allow them that. Rather, they want government to allow them that autonomy. And so they've been fighting, but they're quite well equipped, and they've been fighting the government for a while. They've been kidnapping military, and they've been really giving the government a run for their money. The problem, of course, is that the Rohingya are stuck in the middle of that struggle. Myanmar is the country fighting, the military of Myanmar are fighting some of the longest, ethnic battles with ethnic minorities in the world. And along practically every border, they've been doing that. And so the military uses those same kind of tactics of rape and arson, and it's really terrible. But the problem is, of course, the Rohingya do not have an organized force, and they're not able to defend themselves. And just a few weeks ago, girls playing in an abandoned village, children were blown up by landmines, because it's basically an active conflict zone that they are now stuck in the middle of.
Okay. You spoke about the internet blackout, which is there in force since September 2019, and of course we can find parallels to what just a month before the people of Kashmir were subjected to an internet blackout as well. Although a few weeks ago, or just around the time the lockdown started in India, there was a partial relaxation, but then again full force. So obviously the reason for the internet blackout, although they're in the Bangladeshi area, is there pressure from the Myanmar government, or is there also pressure from the Indian government for them to maintain this internet blackout?
So in Myanmar itself, a few townships have this blackout, and that's been carrying on as well. And that is by order of the telecommunications, the government ordering the telecommunications ministry. In Bangladesh, however, the blackout is imposed by the Bangladeshi government, and they're basically citing security concerns. But what we know is that in June of 2016, the UN General Assembly affirmed the right to internet access. And this requires that people must be afforded access to the internet so they can exercise and enjoy their rights to freedom of expression and opinion and other fundamental human rights. And that states all have a responsibility to ensure that the internet access is broadly available and they do not unreasonably restrict access to the internet. Now, the issue with that is we've been seeing in recent times, whether it's in Hong Kong and Sudan, in Kashmir, as you mentioned, states are increasingly understanding that people are using the internet to organize and to share information. And the minute they want to put pressure on a population, what they're doing is cutting the internet. And the problem specifically in Cox's Bazar is that this internet ban runs over all 34 refugee camps. And the Rohingya have to rely on their mobile phones and their internet access to communicate violations of their human rights to the rest of the world, to access their families overseas that they've been separated from, to access news and information. Of course, very few Rohingya in the camps have access to schooling, so young people can use the internet to, as a, you know, a way to educate themselves. And also, as we discussed earlier, with the coronavirus, having an internet shutdown is a disaster in the camps, because not just for the Rohingya to understand better what corona is, but because aid workers and community leaders are all using the internet to effectively work. And so if there's no internet available in those areas in the camp, how should these aid workers and humanitarian agencies properly, you know, work and disseminate aid and disseminate information? And that's why, as you are aware, today is Black for Rohingya, and we've had wonderful participation already from all over the world. But our focus today is on asking people to pressure the Bangladeshi government to lift this internet ban. And we actually have a petition that's running as well, so listeners can sign that. And this is something active we can all do, because if we put enough pressure on the Bangladeshi government, then they'll be forced to drop the ban, and the Rohingya, inshallah, will be able to have internet access in the camps again.
Yes, in fact, I was just going to ask you about the Black for Rohingya Day. So it is today, the 13th of June.
Yes, today is Black for Rohingya, and we're really excited. It's the seventh time that we're running this awareness campaign.
Right.
Of course, we began way back in 2013, and the first one was in July, but then we moved it to the 13th of June from 2014 onwards, and we wanted to do this to commemorate the Rohingya who were massacred in Arakan State in June of 2012. And every year, alhamdulillah, you know, the participation grows, and this year has been wonderful because we've had a lot of international participation and international Rohingya groups and individuals from all over the world. And I urge the listeners to put on something black, you know, and to give a message of solidarity and to use the hashtag Black for Rohingya, and to send that to us on Twitter, on Instagram, to upload it on Facebook. We really want it to trend today. And everyone's always saying, well, what can we do? Today is something you can do. You can join the movement by wearing black, and you can sign the petition asking the Bangladeshi government to lift the internet ban.
Okay, just for the benefit of the listeners, it's hashtag black, B-L-E-C-K, four, as in numeric 4, and Rohingya, R-O-H-I-N-G-Y-A. Sister Shabnam, just to for the benefit of the listeners, can you please give the Protect the Rohingya Facebook page details, Twitter handle, and the Instagram quickly?
Okay, so on Twitter, it's at capital P Protect, capital R Rohingya. And on Instagram, it's at Protect the Rohingya, the four words. And on Facebook, you just have to put in Protect the Rohingya, and you'll see a little fist icon, because there are a few groups we found recently that there's another group that has copied our name and our logo. So just make sure that you're in the group. There's around 15,000 members on that group, so please make sure that you're joining the correct group. And it's been wonderful because people in Australia and Thailand started really early this morning. For us, it was yesterday that they started. And so there's a wonderful collection of images coming across. If you go into Twitter and you just put in the hashtag, you'll see all the wonderful images, some from the camps, some from Rakhine State, some from Cox's Bazar, from London, from the US, from Ireland. So it's really been a great collection of images, and we're looking forward to much more participation through today.
Okay, before I come to the ICJ case and the Argentina case, just quickly talk about this trafficking of the Rohingya that's currently taking place.
Okay, so, you know, since the beginning of the corona situation, there's been these stories in the media, and we saw just this week, around on the 8th of June, so that was just a few days ago, Malaysian authorities detained around 269 Rohingya refugees who had arrived on a damaged boat just off Langkawi. We all know, you know, that island in Malaysia. And there's a second boat with around 300 Rohingya on it who remain near an island in Thailand. And they're saying that both those boats left in February of this year. That means they've been in the ocean now for 4 months without access to adequate food and water. And on a previous boat of Rohingya found bound for Malaysia, those were rescued by the Bangladeshi Coast Guard eventually. And they think that as many as 100 people could have died on that boat because of the conditions on the boat. And if we can talk a little bit about conditions on these boats, what happens is Rohingya, because of the desperate situation they're in, they pay these traffickers or people smugglers who then take them on small boats from the shore to bigger boats that are a little bit inside the sea. And when they get in, they are literally sitting in slave ship-like conditions. They can barely move their feet. They might get one meal a day initially and then one meal maybe every 2 days. They don't have drinking water, so people are forced to drink seawater. There's abuse by the people smugglers. They hit people. They beat people. They rape women. And one of the survivors was saying that, you know, sometimes they put the engines on, both engines on simultaneously on the boat to drown out the sound of the fact that they're throwing bodies overboard, because people cannot survive in conditions like that. And
reminds one of the old, sorry?
Sorry, yes, you were saying?
I said it reminds one of the old movie series called Roots, when, you know, when it showed about the slavery, the drive of slavery from Africa to the Americas. And, that, of course, when we were growing up, I'm talking in the 80s, it was actually banned in South Africa because, you know, of apartheid and, you know, and it was sympathy towards to black lives. But this is absolutely horrific what you're telling. And in fact, the Rohingya, the Syrians are going through it, and the Yemenis and Afghanis, they're on the Mediterranean. And we obviously seen a lot of that coming through, how many people have been drowning, and refugees from Northern Africa, from Libya, and they're going across. So this is just one more added, sad episode to what is currently what people, desperate people, are faced with. And, I mean, to be, as you said, for, you know, to run those engines and just to, you know, so they can drown out the sound, so that when they're throwing people overboard, that's, I mean, it's beyond sickening.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about the cramped conditions like that, and the fact that women are being raped in those cramped conditions, mm-hmm. how traumatizing it is, not just, like, obviously for the victims, but for everyone that's watching, and how terrified they must be of these smugglers. And sometimes the smugglers call their families, you know, it's a historic thing they do, and torture and threaten until the families send them more money. And one of the director generals of a maritime agency said that around 70% of the Rohingya were not even able to walk when they arrived on those boats. Because, I mean,
because
obviously their
bodies are numb and,
stuck.
Mm-hmm. And their limbs and that, yeah.
And the problem was, is that, so initially when the first boat of almost 400 was trying to get to Malaysia, Malaysian authorities pushed that boat back. Now, we all know in international law, pushbacks are illegal. And they did this under the guise of COVID-19. But they could have easily let the Rohingya onto the shore and quarantined them. But they didn't. So for 2 months, the boats, or for 4 months, these boats continue in the ocean on these terrible journeys. And eventually one boat made it to Bangladesh. The Bangladeshi sent that boat directly to Basanchal, which is very, very problematic. And then the other situation is that Bangladesh itself is saying, well, they don't want to take any more Rohingya in. And Malaysia is saying that Rohingya that they take in on these boats must be returned to Bangladesh, or the UNHCR, the High Commission for Refugees at the UN, must resettle them in the third country. And now they're saying, you know, there's almost probably 1,000 Rohingya still stuck at sea. Of course, governments are denying that that's the fact. But it really reminds us of 2015, where around 8,000 Rohingya were just stuck in the middle of the Andaman Sea like this. You know, and because trafficking rings were busted, they had nowhere to go, and these traffickers just left them. And it's such an indictment on those countries. I mean, especially in Ramadan, during COVID, when we know that refugees are the ones who have it the worst around the world in these times because of their vulnerable positions, because in a time of lockdown and quarantine, they are trying to cross borders and they're living in these terribly cramped conditions. To push them back into the ocean like this, it's really unforgivable.
Okay, now coming to the ICJ case, we know what the ICJ recently ruled on. In fact, I did cover that at the time of, in January, I spoke to Brother Rone Swin about the situation there, and then it was the bull up to the ICJ matter. And of course, you know, when the ruling came out, you know, which was obviously putting the Myanmar government on terms and, you know, waiting for them to, you know, come up with more credible information or whatever they need to. But the thing is that the update since then, has there been any update apart from what we've seen recently about the you know, the post that they want all social media posts to be submitted, or who's calling for these social media posts to be submitted for evidence?
So that's basically the latest just this week, where lawyers at the ICJ case have asked the U.S. District Court to order Facebook to release posts and communications from the country's military and police. So all the documents and communications produced, drafted, anything posted or published on Facebook by the Myanmar military officials and police, as well as those 20 accounts that were banned in August of 2018 for furthering the aims of genocide, including the page of the commander-in-chief of the Myanmar military, Ming Aung Hlaing, and because they're saying that this may constitute evidence of genocidal intent. And so that's going to be a step forward. And of course, just last week, around the 22nd, under the provisional measures, Myanmar had to give their first report back to the ICJ, which they did. The contents are secret for now. They've been passed on to Gambia. Hopefully they will soon be made public. Activists are asking, you know, for them to be made public to see what Myanmar is saying on how they've stopped, you know, this genocide and stopped destroying evidence. So we look forward to seeing what that report holds and what the responses to those reports are.
Okay, and can you please enlighten us about the Argentina case?
Okay, so last year, a court in Argentina decided to pursue the case against Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi and senior officers in the military over the genocide and persecution of the Rohingya. And then last Monday, the Burmese Rohingya organization in the UK said that the Federal Criminal Chamber accepted the petition and asked for more information to be collected on the genocide. But actually in May, the previous over had been overturned, but now the court is interested again to say that this will be moving forward, but they're just going to request more information from the International Criminal Court to ensure that the case in Argentina does not duplicate other efforts. So initially they thought the court would not be taking it, they are taking it, and they have asked for more information. So that's a great success. And of course that matter is brought under the principle of universal jurisdiction, and that means that certain crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, are such grave crimes that they're the responsibility of every country.
Okay. And then last month we saw, unfortunately, a sudden hate speech surge in Malaysia. And, you know, if you can talk to us about that. And then at the same time, I have done some fact-finding, and I would like to also share some views on that. If first you can enlighten the listeners.
Sure. Okay, so basically what happened is that first I said that the founder of a Rohingya organization in Malaysia has demanded citizenship. This was a fake claim, but unfortunately what happened was it coincided with these boats of Rohingya trying to enter Malaysia, the ones that we just spoke about, and suddenly, you know, because of the COVID situation and all of that, there was a surge in hate speech. There were online petitions and statements. Malaysians really went crazy in a disgusting way and in a very unexpected way. And as a result of that, even people who support the Malaysian people who are activists and support the Rohingya cause, one of them we know personally as our organization, and she, her name is Tengu Emma, and she basically wrote this letter, open letter that was published, and she said that, you know, Malaysia must let this Rohingya boat in because of the terrible conditions and these people are trying to enter the country. And even her herself, she faced a lot of violent threats and threats of sexual abuse, and she had to actually go and open a police file. And so it really got ugly, and it continues to. And there were statements made like, oh, they understand why the Myanmar military is doing that, and they would also sign up to kill Rohingya, and all sorts of disgusting things. And so there were letters by a whole lot of international human rights organizations to the authorities in Malaysia saying that they have to do something about this. It's hate speech, and it's not acceptable. And I'm not sure if it's quietened, or it has quietened down a little bit, but I'm not sure if it's quietened down entirely, because just this week, one of the mosques in Malaysia put up signs and said that they would not allow foreigners to come in and pray in the mosque, and that really gathered, you know, a lot of anger from people around the world. But that is currently the situation in Malaysia.
Now, in fact, now coming to that, the thing is that, you know, unfortunately, Malaysia is a, you know, firstly a melting pot of cultures between three major ethnic identities, being the Malay, the Chinese, and the Indians. Chinese that came generally from northeastern China and central China, the Indians that came from South India, Kerala, and Tamil Nadu, as well as Punjabi people, and then of course you've got the ethnic Malay. The reason why I'm saying this is because I've been familiar with Malaysia and having had interest there for 25 years since my first time there. I lived there for 1 year. I've got a lot of friends, in fact, who are close to the former Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, and I had the privilege of meeting him also personally in his previous tenure. I've been following the politics very well. In fact, from about 22 years, I've been daily visiting the various news websites. And unfortunately, what I've noticed, and you are correct in what you're saying, so not there to, you know, to deny or say this is not happening. It is happening. It is sad. For a society that is generally very docile and very polite and very friendly, that this is happening. Now, one has to look further than that. And I don't know if you recall Dr. Mahathir's speech last year at the UN General Assembly when Imran Khan spoke as well. They spoke about Kashmir, he spoke about Palestine, and he also touched on the Rohingya, and he's made also some more vocal calls about the Rohingya plight, which in his recent second tenure as Prime Minister, and which, of course, he had to resign at the end of February due to problems. Now, the successor who's there at the moment in place, the Prime Minister Mohideen, as far as I'm concerned, absolute useless, and you're not going to get anything out of him, unfortunately, because he can be easily swayed and influenced. And coming to that, as I said, given the ethnic diversities, Malays, generally, Muslims make up 60%, Chinese make up 30%, Indians make up 10%. The problem is that 40% in the country. Right now, not that the Muslims that are Muslims that are innocent, as you said, the masjid had that, and I'm aware of that masjid, or that you know, having that sign, etc. But the problem is that, and I saw this parallels happening with the Zakir Naik matter late last year, whereby there was a sudden call for Zakir Naik to be expelled from Malaysia. Now, Dr. Zakir Naik has been living in Malaysia since he has been on the India's wanted list after the one coffee shop bombing that took place in Bangladesh. And conveniently, it was the perpetrators were followers of Dr. Zakir Naik and his Peace TV channel, which was beamed throughout India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, in fact, throughout the subcontinent. And I have been following Dr. Zakir Naik. Again, alhamdulillah, I had the privilege of meeting him when he came to South Africa on a tour where we were involved in co-hosting. I met him in India as well at his center in Bombay, running a wonderful girls' school, which is now, unfortunately, all have been shut down. And the thing is that the way I'm coming on this is that the problem, and this is where social media comes in, is that the RSS, which never had much influence into Malaysia, although the 10% Indian population of Malaysia are majority Hindu, right? They never had really much sway into Malaysia, and Malaysia never tolerated if I can put it to you this way, the intolerance between the various religions. Unfortunately, this is what we've noticed, is that since he's been there, the RSS have mobilized and have got people on board, which is very sad. And then, of course, with the Chinese. Now, the Malaysian Chinese who are there for generations are good and big contributors to society and are part and parcel of Malaysian society. However, there's also a certain loyalty that's there to China. And you find that when it comes to, because Chinese government is very closely allied to the Burmese government or the Myanmar government as well. So you'll find that over the Rohingya, there's a lot of pressure through the Chinese community on the Malaysian government to basically not to provide too much of benefit to the Rohingya. At the same time, also when it came over the Uyghur matter, you also seen that like it's an absolute silence. And this is a contradiction given that Malaysia has been extremely vocal on Palestine. I still remember I was there on one visit back in February 2003 when it was the non-aligned NAM summit. And I was there at the time. I was on holiday, but I was closely following what was happening. And Dr. Mahathir spoke out vocally about the impending U.S. and British invasion on Iraq, which happened a month later. We saw the downfall of Saddam Hussein. They have been vocal about what's happening in Syria, about what's happening in Yemen. So, yes, Sister Shabnam, what is happening there is unfortunate, and we only appeal to, through the activists that you are linked up to in Malaysia, to the Muslim community of Malaysia, to basically see through all this negativity and come to some sense and realization and take charge. Fortunately, the humanitarian groups like Islamic Relief Malaysia and Mercy Malaysia and a whole lot of them are there to make the difference, but they can do only so much. So I hope basically I've given a bit of insight from my side and, on this matter. And we pray for our Rohingya brother and sister. On my last visit, I met a lot of them, and I was very touched and saddened to hear what's going on and, how they had to basically just run, whatever they had on them, mm-hmm. and suffering and, struggling. Anyway, Sister Shabnam, Jazakallah for your time, and we'll be in touch again, inshallah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, then.
And we hope you're wearing black today.
Yes, 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 of course. I'm going to make sure I'll change my shirt when I go home.
Thank you very much.
Okay, then. Assalamu alaikum. And listeners, you've heard what Sister Shabnam said. Today is the Black for Rohingya Day, hashtag Black Numeric for Rohingya. Please go on to the various social media platforms, the Twitter handle, Protect Rohingya. So it's at Protect Rohingya. Then you've got on Instagram, Protect the Rohingya, and for Facebook, search Protect the Rohingya with the first attached to it and follow that page, not the other copycat pages, because it could be fake news or people who are obviously trying to confuse. Now, coming to the other matters that I have that I plan to talk about is that there's always been this misconception amongst a lot that with the current onslaught against Muslims throughout the world, and we know very well who are the main perpetrators of this. It started off with the British and the French, generally with the Europeans, and then of course in the past 120 years the Americans are on board. And we thought, okay, it's only with the Americans. Of course, Israel is part of it, but it doesn't stop there, because we have others that are against that have this agenda against Muslims, but they're very clever manipulators of fake news and know how to manipulate public perception of them in their favor. And one of those countries, or should I say two of those countries, is Russia and China. But I want to focus on Russia today and talk about a deadly, bloody mercenary group called the Wagner Group. A lot of you have heard of the American mercenary group called Blackwater. They've been very strong in Iraq since the second invasion in 2003. The havoc they've done there, they now go as ZXE, but this is Blackwater. The Wagner Group is Russia's equivalent of Blackwater. And I want to play a short 9-minute clip to put you, the listeners, to make you aware of who the Wagner Group is.
Everyone knows about the U.S. and Blackwater, right? But have you heard of the Wagner Group? Well, if you haven't, then you might want to listen up, because it's arguably the world's most effective mercenary army, created, funded, and controlled by Russia. It acts as President Vladimir Putin's invisible hand in Syria, Libya, Sudan, Ukraine, Venezuela, the CAR, and even Madagascar. The group has created troll armies, tampered with Western democracies and electoral processes, fought and won real wars, taken over strategic territories, carried out assassinations, and the cherry on top of the cake, Russia's political interests are fulfilled while maintaining plausible deniability. First off, let's start with the man who is allegedly behind Wagner PMC, or Wagner Private Military Company. He goes by the name of Yevgeny Prigozhin. As a young adult, Prigozhin was sentenced to 9 years in prison for robbery and fraud. After he was released, he became a hot dog vendor. But the ex-convict had big aspirations. Coupled with Russia's shocking transition to capitalism in the 1990s, Prigozhin expanded his business by setting up St. Petersburg's first grocery chain, and then went into luxury restaurants. In 2001, the man himself, Vladimir Putin, started dining in Prigozhin's New Island, a luxury floating restaurant in his hometown of St. Petersburg. Prigozhin didn't waste the opportunity to personally serve his president, and so the two men hit it off. Now, the hot dog seller suddenly found himself a spot in the president's elite circle, earning him the nickname Putin's chef. The pivotal point in his life came with many benefits, including billion-dollar military and school catering contracts and tenders that enabled him to become a construction magnate. Over the last 20 years, he has engaged in a wide range of other businesses and activities with the Kremlin. And the equation is simple. Prigozhin's commercial interests and the Kremlin's pursuit of national interests were aligned. Wagner PMC is at the heart of this Russian roulette. Wagner PMC was born out of the conflict in Ukraine. During the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014, the Russian army turned to Wagner's mercenaries, known as Little Green Men. They were reportedly involved in shooting down a Ukrainian IL-76 military airlift, assassinated rogue separatist leaders, and participated in the Battle of Debaltseve. For the fighters, mostly army veterans, it is clearly a money game. In 3 months, a mercenary can make around 1 million Russian rubles, or $16,000, which goes a long way in that part of the world. And in some cases, it's more than 10 times what they'd be paid as a regular soldier. A commander can earn about 3 times more. If they die in combat, their families will receive around $56,000. For Russia, having mercenaries serves its purpose threefold. It gets battle-hardened mercenaries and doesn't need to deal with inactive veterans. But most importantly, Moscow gets to maintain plausible deniability while expanding its foreign policy reach. In other words, Russia can say it's not officially interfering in Libya, but can fulfill its strategic interests by having Wagner mercenaries there. Nearly a decade after its first appearance, Wagner has now spread across the world. This chart helps visualize the connection between Prigozhin's commercial interests and Russia's foreign policy engagement. But there is more. Prigozhin's other commercial interests also align with where Wagner mercenaries go. So, for instance, in January 2018, Prigozhin's Evropolis signed a contract with the Syrian state-owned General Petroleum Corporation. Evropolis would get 25% of the output from any petroleum facilities retaken for Bashar al-Assad by Wagner mercenaries. A month later, Wagner mercenaries were involved in a risky assault on a U.S.-operated oil outpost in eastern Syria. U.S. intelligence revealed Prigozhin had participated directly in planning the attack. But the mission was actually a failure, as U.S. forces successfully repelled this provocative action by killing 200 to 300 Wagner mercenaries. Despite this reckless overstepping, there is no doubt that Russia's arrival in Syria in 2015 was a game changer. Wagner played an important role in providing a lifeline to Syria's Bashar al-Assad. 2,500 of Prigozhin's men were reportedly sent to guard energy and military facilities. helping Assad simultaneously protect facilities and mount offensives to recapture territories. A key example is the Palmyra offensive in 2016, during which it supplied the initial shock force to reclaim the city from Daesh. A Russian military source speaking to RBC News said this about how fighting goes down in Syria. First, Wagner's guys go to work, then the Russian ground units come in and the Arabs and the cameras. And the group stands accused of gross human rights violations. A horrifying video of Wagner mercenaries breaking a Syrian man's legs with a sledgehammer, crushing his chest, beheading him and cutting off his lower arms was published recently. The victim was identified as Mohammed Taha, a Syrian national who was accused of deserting a unit loyal to Assad. Putin and his chef have taken this war machine and used it in their rapid scramble for Africa. Russia outbid France to obtain an exception to the United Nations CAR arms embargo in 2018. Stratfor reported that 370 Wagner contractors were deployed to CAR, providing security for President Faustin Archange Touadéra. Obviously, the service isn't free of charge. CAR is rich in diamonds, oil, gold and uranium, and the Russian Foreign Ministry has discussed mining concessions with Touadéra. The Russians have initiated diamond extraction already, and Wagner appears to have taken up security at the mines. It is important to note that three Russian journalists were killed in CAR in the summer of 2018. The journalists were investigating Wagner's presence there and were planning to film gold mines in Libya, the land of Omar Mukhtar. Expansion is still on the cards for Putin and his chef. Evidence of Wagner's presence in Libya's sandy plains surfaced in November 2018 when footage revealed Prigozhin sitting among prominent Russian defense officials in a meeting with the LNA. Also, two Russian nationals were caught a year later and accused of tampering with local elections and gathering intelligence on military outposts. By the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, Wagner mercenaries are allegedly used as snipers, drone pilots, and to train LNA soldiers. The head of the LNA, warlord Khalifa Haftar, has been quietly and steadily backed by Russia. Moscow has an interest in the energy resources in Haftar-controlled territories and signed an oil offtake deal in 2017. Once again, Russia is trying to leverage guns and money to find itself in an advantageous position in post-war Libya. It's more or less a similar situation in Sudan, Madagascar, and Venezuela. Prigozhin is acting as Putin's private enabler. Putin's chef has also earned himself another nickname, the King of Dislikes, and this is due to his involvement in setting up troll armies and spreading fake news. The US government has indicted Prigozhin and another 13 Russians over fraud and deceit for the purpose of interfering with the US political and electoral processes. He is being directly accused of spending significant funds on the Internet Research Agency, a St. Petersburg body that has been nicknamed the Russian Troll Factory. These Russian trolls are accused of tampering with the US elections and other democracies such as the UK and France. And so it should be now very clear that Prigozhin has his finger in many pies. But this can also have dire consequences such as the US indictment. His companies are on the sanctions list and news agencies around the world have tried to shed light on his clandestine activities. So will Russia's quest to capitalize on humanitarian crisis pay off? Will the crimes committed by Wagner continue? And as with Blackwater, will justice be evaded?
Okay, my dear listeners, you've heard that shocking clip about the Wagner Group. It is for real. It is here in Africa. In fact, it's right here on our doorstep in northern Mozambique, which many of us are not aware of. There have been certain articles that have been going around of what's happening there. Of course, the usual, the people who are resisting them are treated as the usual suspects, terrorists, ISIS, Islamic fundamentalists, Al-Qaeda, etc., and then none of those. The problem is that what's happening in Mozambique is that the northern area of Mozambique is rich in gas reserves, and the Russians want to mine those gas reserves for their own benefit, and the people living on those lands are majority Muslims, and they are dead against this because they do not want to they do not want to be uprooted, they do not want to lose their livelihoods, they do not want to they basically do not want this to go ahead, and they are resisting. Of course, what happens? You form, if you resist, you form militias. and you basically take them on. And this is what they're doing. And now what's the news filtering through? These are terrorists, the usual. As you could see in Syria, the similar thing happened when the people stood up against Bashar al-Assad. These are terrorists. These are armed gangs. So, I mean, the thing is that when the Muslims are labeled as terrorists and fundamentalists, and of course we saw ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever, it's convenient. It started with the Americans, copied by the British and the French. Of course, the Israelis were there on board, and suddenly it's become a common swear word amongst those that are part of us. The Arabs are using it in some the dictatorial regimes of Sisi, the Gulf Royals, Saudi Arabia, Assad, as well as the regime of Iran as well. They also talk about ISIS and Al-Qaeda and terrorists. And then you've got, of course, the Russians and the Chinese. And all along people have been saying, but the Russians are standing up to the West. Please do not be delusional. There's no such thing that the Russians are standing up to the West for us, our interest as Muslims. They don't give a damn. What they are doing is that they are playing the sympathy card for Muslims and telling Muslims that, listen, we are aware of what the Americans and the Western imperialists and the Israelis are doing to you, so we are standing up to them and we are also fighting your cause. Meanwhile, the world is one big fat cake which all these superpowers want their share of. And that's what you're exactly seeing at the moment. I mean, just to talk about the Wagner Group activities here in Africa. In Libya, we all heard what you saw, heard on the clip there about Khalifa Haftar, who is known as the famous warlord of the LNA Libyan National Army, and his allies of tribes that are forcing the GNA, which is the Government of National Accord, headed by Fayez Sarraj. Now, the LNA is backed by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE, France, Russia, Israel, and Syria. But wait a minute, in Syria, and Syria under Bashar al-Assad, that is, right? In Syria, the Saudis and the Emiratis are against Bashar al-Assad. And who supports Bashar al-Assad? Russia. And then Bashar al-Assad turns around and says, but I'm standing up to the Western Israel. Lies. Then you come across the GNA, which is the Government of National Accord. They've been popularly supported by Italy, Qatar, and of course Turkey. Now, the reason for Turkey's involvement was that the Haftar was basically on the doorstep, on the outskirts of the capital, Tripoli, just to make you listeners aware that in the Libyan civil war, the eastern half of the country is controlled by Haftar, who is not internationally recognized, and the eastern half of the country and the western half is controlled by the GNA, the Government of National Accord. And that is the current world-recognized government. And what happened was that Israel got involved because Haftar needed to basically take over Tripoli, and Turkey intervened, causing the Wagner Group to retreat. Now, at the moment, as we speak, the Wagner Group is regrouping. Why? Because Israel is involved, and Israel is providing military and intelligence, as well as arms. The Israeli military and intelligence arms are highly specialized in street warfare with the Wagner Group. Obviously taking onto this because this is perfect. You basically cause chaos and civil war. And Haftar, this has come about because Haftar met secretly with the Mossad, Israeli's intelligence, in 2018, which was set up by the UAE and Russia. So the thing is, and the UAE and Russia are supplying weapons, sniper rifles, night visions, together with the Israelis. So you can see what a mess this is happening in Libya. And talking about Syria, just in conclusion, that the clip also mentioned about this person that was beheaded and arms were chopped off. Just to let you know that this clip was circulating last year in November. Right now, the clip that was going on around social media showed several men in military-style clothing, right, beating up a Syrian prisoner with a sledgehammer, beheading him, amputating his arms with a sapper's trowel, right, and then pouring gasoline over his body and setting his body alight. The Russian-speaking man who videoed this is a mercenary known as Stanislav D., who is a former police officer from southern Russia's region of Stavropol. He joined the Wagner Group in 2016, and in his own words, the reason why I joined the Wagner Group is to protect the interest of the Russian Federation abroad. Okay, the snippets of this 2017 video were going around before, but in in mid-November 2019, the full video came about, and we saw it on social media, and it was a terrible, gruesome video. And what it was that the man was falsely accused of deserting the Assad army. So this is what you've got. Whoever thinks that Russia is standing up to the West, standing up against Israel, that's all lies. They're all there to serve their own interest. It's just that who wants more of the share of the cake? That's what's the problem. Anyway, Jazakallah for listening to the Radio Islam listeners. I'm going off now for the Radio Al-Ansar listeners. We'll be continuing after the 12 o'clock news, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.